Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and to give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 07-7132, Amir Reza Ovesi, Appellant versus Islamic Republic of Iran et al. Mr. Spertus for the appellant.
Good morning,
Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is James Spertus, and seated with me at counsel table and on the briefs is Ezra Landis, an associate and colleague from my office. We represent Amir Ovesi, who is seeking to recover damages he personally suffered when his grandfather was brutally murdered on Paris streets in 1984. Your Honors, we're appealing from a decision from the district court, Judge Lambert below, that denied Mr. Ovesi standing and technically jurisdiction to pursue two causes of action, a wrongful death claim against the Republic of Iran, and separately, and a claim for intentional infliction of emotional distress. Judge Lambert, in the wrongful death action, confused the survival statutes that are available to litigants in California with wrongful death.
I ask about that. The question before that is, why is California at all as compared to France as the choice of law decision? So if we applied District of Columbia choice of law, how do we get to California rather than France?
Your Honor,
and does it matter to you, actually, which of the two we get to?
Well, it does matter. Judge Lambert correctly applied a choice of law analysis when he considered determined the plaintiff's last place of domicile. Mr. Ovesi, Amir Ovesi, is a United States citizen who was born in California and then left with his parents to live with his grandfather in Paris, France. The parents chose an actual domicile in Paris, but at the time, Mr. Ovesi was a minor, and the place of his birth is his domicile for purposes of a choice of law analysis.
Where do you get that idea from?
Why
is the place, if you're a minor and you're living in France and your parents' domicile is France, why, for choice of law purposes, obviously your citizenship remains American, but why is your domicile other than France?
Well, that issue is addressed in the Damerel decision, and there's a large body of law doing that appropriate choice of law analysis.
In the Damerel decision, the ground, I'll just read you the section that seems relevant to me and doesn't seem relevant here. It says, this is page 20, says, the particular characteristics of this case heighten the interests of a domestic forum and diminish the interests of the foreign state. The injuries in this case are the result of a state-sponsored terrorist attack on a United States embassy and diplomatic personnel. The United States has a unique interest in its domestic law rather than that of a foreign nation determining damages in a suit involving such an attack. So when the terrorist organization or state intentionally attacks a facility of the United States, of course the United States has more of an interest. But at least on the facts as they're described in the district court's opinion, there was an intention by the terrorists to attack somebody of Iranian descent, but there wasn't a particular aim at the United States. So I'm not sure why Damerel applies to this case.
Well, there was an attack against a United States citizen in this case. I mean, Amir Ovesi is a direct and a third party victim of the attack.
Is there any evidence that you've put in the record at all that the purpose of this was to injure the grandson as compared to the decedent, who was not an American citizen?
Well, Judge Lambert, I submit correctly, found that terrorist attacks by their nature are addressed at the person who's killed and their immediate family.
Right, but is there evidence that the Iranians knew that the immediate family was American as compared to French or Iranian or anything else?
No. There's no.
So then, unlike Damerel, where the intention of the terrorists was to affect the United States, is there evidence in this record that the intention of the terrorists was to affect the United States?
No, there is not, Your Honor. But if I may explain,
please.
The attack intended to kill Golam Ovesi. Right. And the fortuity, I submit, maybe that Amir Ovesi was a U.S. citizen when he was in the immediate family member of a terrorist victim. But all of the terrorist cases that involve U.S. citizens, the Flatow decision, for example, even the attack on the U.S. embassy that was at issue in the Heiser decision by Judge Lambert, involved a mixture of U.S. citizens and non-U.S. citizens. The U.S. citizens, by virtue of their citizenship, have the right to recover through the exception to the foreign sovereign.
It's not a question of right to recover at all. It's only a question of which law applies. I'm not sure Flatow would have been hurt by having Israeli law apply. Right. I mean, Flatow was killed, I believe, in Israel.
In Israel, yes.
Her family would not have been disfavored by having Israeli law apply. That is, apply in an American court. I'm not talking about foreign nonconvenience here. I'm talking about just conflicts of laws.
Well, I believe that the law is, as was applied in Flatow, that it's the plaintiff's place of domicile. So it's not the victim. It's the person bringing the claim.
Her domicile was in the United States. She was just visiting Israel. This is unlike this situation where the family had basically moved to France.
But I submit that if the Flatows had moved to France, the same choice of law would have applied. The last place of chosen domicile of the plaintiff.
Is there a case? I guess I'm looking for a case, and not a district court case here, but a case in the District of Columbia, or a case applying District of Columbia law, that where all the events occur in another country, and it's a country that, you know, whose judicial system we respect and we have no reason to believe has a different rule on these questions than our own, and where everybody lives in the foreign country. Is there a case like that?
Well, and I do believe that Damerol too, Your Honor, does address that. They do expressly conduct the choice of law analysis, and I believe they did it correctly, and where they expressly state the plaintiff's last place of domicile is
the
correct place.
I know, but the court is focusing on, you know, sort of the exception for U.S. citizens who are assigned abroad, whether it's part of the military or part of the State Department. And facts here, or the record is just so different. In other words, under the District of Columbia choice of law test, wouldn't France have the greater interest here?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe that because I believe the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act is designed to protect U.S. citizens. So I understand the difference between being assigned to a foreign country where everybody understands that someday, even though the date might not be defined, the individual will move back to the United States. Here we have an individual who was, as a minor, taken to France, possibly to permanently relocate, and then through the tragedy, they relocated temporarily to Morocco and ultimately back to the United States. But this is a U.S. citizen, and at the time of the murder in 1984, he did have a domicile, a last domicile in the United States. And whether or not he intended at the time he moved to Paris to return to the United States or not, I submit there is a state in California whose state law would control his claim.
But doesn't the district court actually look at the district's choice of law analysis?
The district court here did, and I submit there's just a mistake in Judge Lambert's analysis. Respectfully, Judge Lambert cites to Demerol as the basis for finding that California law applies, but then the mistake is that Judge Lambert stated that the decedent's place of domicile controls, and that's how Judge Lambert sought to look to Paris law.
What is your understanding of the district's choice of law rules? I mean, how do you analyze what choice of law controls?
You look to state law at the place of the plaintiff's, the claimant's domicile. I mean, the domicile for the plaintiff, not the decedent.
And you don't look at the balance of interest at all? That's your understanding?
No. Well, the balance of interest was decided by Congress in the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act. I know it might appear circular to the court, but in protecting a U.S. citizen's right to bring a claim under the exception, Congress has afforded the claimant venue and jurisdiction in the United States to apply the state law. This is the I understand the court's question, but I submit that Demerol and Heiser both support that the court should apply state law, the appropriate state law. And the appropriate state law, which Judge Lambert mistakenly said was the decedent's domicile, should in fact be the plaintiff's domicile.
But the District of Columbia's conflict of laws rule is not that rule. The District of Columbia rule does not say wherever the plaintiff's domicile is, that's where the law is applied.
But the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act does say that the sovereign immunity is stripped away as if the plaintiff can bring a cause of action against Iran, and that and Iran was not a sovereign country. So then you turn to what claim could the plaintiff bring against Iran, and it's state law claims.
Right, but in Pescatore, the Second Circuit held that the conflicts law of the state in which the court is resident, in that case New York, is the law that applies under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. Here you're bringing a case in the District of Columbia, so the conflict of laws rules of the District of Columbia should apply. And the FSIA says that foreign state is to be held liable, quote, in the same manner and to the same extent as a private individual under like circumstances, which means that the conflict of laws rule would also apply. And not something special about the FSIA.
Well, I think that the district is the proper venue for FSIA claims, but the district must look to the underlying plaintiff's domicile, as the court has done in these cases, in Demerol and Heiser, for example, to find the state law that's applicable.
Let me see if I can give you an incentive to go with France. When I look at the law of California with respect to IIED, in the Christensen's case, the Supreme Court of California says it is not enough that the conduct be intentional and outrageous. It must be conduct directed at the plaintiff or occur in the presence of a plaintiff of whom the defendant is aware. So all the discussion we've had that is in the brief and in the district court's opinion about the relationship is irrelevant with respect to conduct not directed at a plaintiff unless the plaintiff is present. And the plaintiff in this case was not present.
Your Honor, the Christensen case, I believe, supports Mr. Ovesi's position in this case.
How?
Well, first of all, in Christensen, the court was addressing negligent infliction of emotional.
No. It's specifically addressing intentional infliction. In the Thing case, it's negligent, but in Christensen, it's about intentional infliction.
Well, in Christensen, they were trying to draw the lines for negligent, and they distinguished intentional infliction of emotional distress, which doesn't have a presence requirement.
It does have a presence requirement. So if you could take a look at the opinion, we'll look at it together. 820 Pacific 2nd, 181, at 903.
We have one moment, Your Honor.
Sure, of course. It's Roman numeral 5, entitled Intentional Infliction of Emotional Distress.
Yes, sir.
Okay, and the 1, 2, 3, the fourth paragraph summarizes Supreme Court of California's view. It is not enough that the conduct be intentional and outrageous. It must be conduct directed at the plaintiff or occur in the presence of a plaintiff of whom the defendant is aware.
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm just wondering if you really want to take the position that only California law applies, how do you come within California law?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that, first of all, this was a terrorist act directed at Mr. Ovesi, at Amir Ovesi, because he was an immediate family member. And the importance of drawing lines.
Yeah, all right. So let me just pause for it. Let me direct you to one more paragraph and ask you if you still take that position.
Thank you.
Move a few paragraphs down. It says, the requirement that defendant's conduct be directed primarily at the plaintiff. Of the two people who it was directed at here, the person was actually assassinated and the grandson. You certainly don't think it was primarily directed at the grandson, do you?
I think it was primarily directed at the immediate family of Golam Ovasi.
Not at Golam Ovasi himself?
I think that he was the cause which directed the immediate family to the attention of the Islamic Jihad. But I mean,
they tried to kill him, not the family. So yes. Wasn't he the primary?
Yes.
So a California law, and we discussed this in our Bettis case also, which is a case more about the general common law, is that most states the rule is that for the direct part, not for the indirect part, it's a primary direct. That is, it's the party who was primarily the object. And in this case, where there's no evidence even that they knew about the family, certainly about our plaintiff, I don't see how anybody other than Golam could be the direct.
Golam was the primary direct, certainly.
Right.
So I do think that the direct victims would encompass the immediate family, but I think that Mr. Ovasi, under a direct or third-party theory, would be able to recover. And I don't think the Christensen's case precludes Mr. Ovasi's cause of action. And the Christensen case, the court even noted that the appellate court below recognition of grandchildren as within the scope of a member's immediate family. And
but what I'm getting, help me get over the problem that it's, that not only do you have to be a member of the immediate family, you have to be present. Leave aside the direct for a moment and look only at the second possibility, or occur in the presence of a plaintiff of whom the defendant is aware. It seems like this opinion is saying that family or not, they have to be present. And this is a strict rule. California apparently has a stricter rule than other places.
Your Honor, I submit the context of the Christensen decision will give some guidance. The in Christensen, that issue was family members and more removed, even friends, who had contracted for burial services to be able to sue the crematoriums for mishandling the loved one's remains. And the court was seeking to draw lines that limited the class to a reasonable number. And I think ultimately the court concluded that those who contract with the crematoriums and immediate family members have standing. Nobody was present in the Christensen case. So there wasn't a single victim in Christensen who was present when the remains of the loved ones were mishandled.
It was, so did any victim succeed on the intentional infliction claim?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe
which,
that they...
Which
they,
one?
I believe that the class was defined as, and if I may have a moment...
I'm not saying I'm reading it correctly. That's why I'm asking you now.
Yes. Your Honor, there was a class that emerged from the Christensen decision that enabled immediate family members and even friends who had contracted for the handling of the remains to recover, but wouldn't allow recovery by more distant persons.
That may be on some of the causes of action. It's IIED that we're talking about. Look at the last paragraph of, this is helpful, look at the last paragraph of Part 5, which is at...
Yes.
We conclude that the model plaintiffs have not alleged that the conduct of any of the defendants was directed primarily at them, was calculated to cause them severe emotional distress, or was done with knowledge of their presence.
Right.
We conclude, therefore, the model complaint does not establish that any of the plaintiffs has standing to sue for intentional infliction of emotional distress.
Your Honor is correct, and the class was, that's why I initially cited Christensen under a negligent infliction of emotional
yes.
distress theory, but there was a class defined for
we don't have negligent infliction here, right?
No, here we have intentional. But Your Honor, each of those three subparts, I submit that in this case I believe that the conduct was directed at Golam Ovasi's immediate family. I think that it was calculated to cause severe emotional distress to Ghulam Ovesi's immediate family, and the family, in fact, was whisked away to Morocco immediately when that murder occurred. And then, as an alternative theory, which is not here, was that the murder was done with knowledge of the family's presence at the point of the killing. And that prong is not here, although the family was present in Paris at the time of the murder. And I certainly would suspect that the Islamic Jihad, doing their surveillance activities, would know that there's immediate family in Paris. But there's no evidence in the record of that type of surveillance, only that the Jihad took credit. But I do believe, Your Honor, that the presence requirement at the point of killing is not a bar to Mr. Ovesi's intentional infliction of emotional distress claim. In this court in Bettis, for example, recognized the right of immediate family members to recover under an intentional infliction of emotional distress, and it was a very similar circumstance. Father Jenko was kidnapped and held hostage. He survived.
The problem in Bettis is that we decided it on a general common law before we later decided in Sisipio and Accra that it had to be a particular state, not general common law. So we didn't have any particular state to look at. And the problem now is that we're looking at a particular state. And so Bettis doesn't really get us to where we have to be. Although Bettis does say with respect to direct victims, it has to be the primary direct. But I'm afraid Bettis just isn't helpful because it doesn't tell us what California law is.
Well, Bettis is helpful in a couple respects. First, Bettis applied the restatement, which is somewhat of a proxy for state law, and California is more protective of the rights of plaintiffs than virtually any other state in the country. Thing and Christensen, for example, both addressed the presence requirement favorably to plaintiffs. The wrongful death standing statute, which is a creature of statute in California, so you actually have a law expressly contemplates that Mr. Ovesi will have standing
On the wrongful death, you're clearly right. But you would be right even if French law applied, because there's little chance that France is going to apply this English statute.
Well, that's correct.
One way or the other, you're not precluded by an ancient English statute from going forward on wrongful death.
Right. And in fact, there's a specific California statute on point. And I do believe the court should look to the California wrongful death statute as a guide. Thing and Christensen apply to the emotional distress claim. The wrongful death claim is expressly set forth in a statute which says that a minor living with the decedent for more than 180 days and is dependent on the decedent can recover.
I thought your position, and I thought it was persuasive, is that we don't look to wrongful death statutes or survivorship rules or anything like that to determine IIED.
That's correct. Right. And I was segueing back to the wrongful death claim just now. But I do believe for standing purposes that when the court was asking what would California law be, we look to Christensen, we look to Thing, and I think looking to the wrongful death statute for guidance is very instructive here, because I think that the courts in California are and the legislature are trying to define a clear line for insurance reasons and other reasons, but define a set of people that can bring their claims. Thing was a unique case, so the grandchild, the decedent was an infant. There was no grandchild. Christensen was a case that did involve grandchildren, and the appellate court below, which was expressly noted by the Supreme Court, recognized rights of grandchildren. And the California wrongful death statute itself expressly addresses minors whether or not they are grandchildren. So a non-grandchild minor living with Ghulam Ovesi for more than 180 days could recover. So I think that the court's choice of law question is the key. But if the court agrees with our arguments that California law would apply because that is the place where Mr. Ovese was born, and that would be his last place of United States domicile before relocating to Paris. Once the court arrives in California, I think the intent of the California legislator and the Supreme Court is very clearly trying to afford plaintiffs like Mr. Ovese in this type of case a right to recover for their own damages, their own injuries. I do think that Judge Lambert, with all due respect, did apply a survival analysis to these claims. And I think that's where the opinion got off track. I think Judge Lambert then properly, if this were a survival claim, looked to the California probate code to try to determine who would have the rights as they flowed among family members to bring a survival claim. And what I want to emphasize is that Mr. Ovese is not bringing a survival claim. So Mr. Ovese is suing to recover for his own injuries. And that's where the Judge Lambert's opinion, I think, deviates from the intent of the California legislator in enacting the wrongful death statute the way it did, and instead causing him to look to the probate code, which would be the proper way to evaluate Golem Ovese's claims. Golem Ovese, although he wouldn't have a wrongful death claim, would have other types of claims against Iran for his murder. And those claims are all abandoned now in this case. It's only Mr. Ovese's claims that are being pursued.
And let me ask you back to Judge Brown's question to you under D.C. choice of law, where there's a balancing. If we were to disagree with you about your reading of the law, of D.C. choice of law regarding last place of domicile as controlling, have you had a chance to look at the amendment to this statute that occurred in 2008?
To the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act?
Yeah, where it repealed the section under which you're suing and basically gives you an option, as I understand it, to file a motion in the district court and proceed?
Your Honor, no, I'm not familiar with that amendment. The cause of action was filed in 2003, and we're proceeding under the amended complaint, which is the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act was, in fact, a conduit to state law at that time. I would be glad to supplement with further briefing on the amendment, the 2008 amendment, if the court would want such briefing.
All right. Any further questions? No, thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anything you wanted to say you didn't get a chance to say since we're in this
odd posture? You can have rebuttal now.
Yes.
Your Honor, I believe that our brief addresses all of the points we wish to make, and I thank the court very much for the time to argue. Thank you.
Thank you. And we'll take the case under advisement.
You're welcome. Yeah, she does.